Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
We're sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Hello, and welcome to the World Cricket Show, the world's favourite cricket show. My name is Adam Bayfield, and I've got statistically the heaviest head of anyone on the World Cricket Show team. And the man butting heads with me tonight goes by the name of Tony Kerr.
I don't know if that's true. My head is big and heavy.
Yes, it's big, both physically and figuratively.
I mean, it's hard to tell the weight of a head just by the size, but I think mine is both big and heavy.
Did you get it, though? Did you get the gag?
It's followed you there.
Bit of topical humour for you, Tony. I know you've always enjoyed that.
My favourite part of this whole thing.
How are you, anyway?
Good. Yeah, not too bad. Not too down. Pragmatic, I suppose.
Philosophical.
Yeah, exactly. Just, yeah, enjoying the whole charade of it.
Tired? On a scale of one to tired, how tired are you right now?
Not too bad. A good night's sleep last night. But you're sort of fighting back from a losing position after Wednesday night in particular.
Yeah, that was tough. The first night was a difficult one, wasn't it?
It's like going down sort of 2-0 early on in a football match. You're always up against it.
I'm not doing too badly now. We are a few days on from the end of the test, so I'm sort of slowly coming back to life. But yeah, for a little while there, I was struggling. They love me at work at the moment. They love me when the Ashes are on. My productivity is just, you know, through the roof. Although that being said, I have to say, you know, this first test has really brought it home to me that I'm getting old. I don't remember struggling as badly on the last tour, and certainly not the one before. Even before the end of the first session, I was asleep. And on the fourth day, like, I feel like I watched the first session of the fourth day, but I've thought back on it. I'm like, yeah, I can't actually remember a single ball that was bowled. I think I was literally just asleep the whole time.
I mean, it is, you know, it's quite tough, isn't it? Because if you were to say to a non-cricket fan, perhaps someone who's actually angry about the Ashes or just about the amount of attention it gets or hates cricket, if you were like, no, come on, sit up with us, you know, watch the start. It's the first session of the biggest series in cricket, you know, and a particularly hyped edition of the biggest series of cricket in this instance, you know, huge, you know, it doesn't get any bigger than this. You know, you stay up, the match gets underway, bit of fanfare, anthems and all that, and then the first few balls are just watched outside off stump. Absolutely nothing happens.
Leave.
Yeah. They would just be like, I'm going to bed. Yeah. It just made me laugh that the first day was so innocuous, so non-eventful.
Well, also, if you talk someone into staying up to watch it with you, and then, like, within 20 minutes, I'm asleep, you know, it's not really selling it to them, is it? Well, should we talk about the cricket then? Should we crack on with it? I mean, I'm not sure that I particularly want to. I argued that there was no real need, but the management have insisted that it is in our contracts, so we're going to have to talk about this.
It's like
this first Ashes test.
Yeah, coming into work on Christmas Day. You know, we don't want to do it, but we're here anyway, so we'll make the best of it.
People may have noticed that there was a test match this week, the first test of the Ashes in Brisbane. I'm sure people don't really need me to go through this scorecard roundup. I was going to ask Alexa to do it. If we recorded at my house, Tone, I've got Alexa. If you ask Alexa, did you listen to that clip that I sent you?
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't get a chance.
Didn't get a chance.
I didn't. Sorry.
Didn't want to.
I did get a lot of this, just a lot of, I can't answer everything.
You get a lot of
fan mail.
A lot of media comes your way.
It's hard. I've got to pick and choose.
I recorded a little audio clip of me asking Alexa for the Ashes score.
Perhaps you could put that in now.
Perhaps I could. It's surprisingly detailed.
Is it?
Yeah, it goes on for ages.
Alexa, what's the score in the Ashes?
The Ashes started on Thursday, November 23rd, 2017, and will end on Monday, January 8th, 2018. Australia and England are competing in the series. On the fifth test day on Thursday, November 23rd, Australia beat England by 10 wickets. England won the toss and decided to bat first.
But you don't have Alexa tone, so instead you're going to have to ask Adam for the Ashes score.
Hey, Adam. Is that what you say? How do I get something out of you? Oi, Adam.
Yeah.
What's the Ashes score?
Australia are 1-0 up after a 10-wicket win in the first test in Brisbane. It looks pretty one-sided, that, doesn't it? But it was a very competitive game for long stretches. England batting first. It was a bit of a wobble at the start, but a brilliant partnership between Mark Stoneman and James Vince meant that they were going along reasonably comfortably at 246 for four, but then there was a bit of a collapse and they were all out for 302. Australia, in response, were wobbling themselves at 209 for seven, but they managed to eke some runs out of the tail. Pat Cummins with 42, put on a great partnership with Steve Smith, who scored a quite remarkable century, 141 not out from 326 balls. They ended up with a bit of a lead, 328, and you felt, you know, it was nervous times for England after that, particularly right at the end of the third day. They had a tricky session to bat there. They lost a couple of wickets, and on the fourth day, they were skittled for just 195 wickets, shared around by the seamers, and 3 wickets for Nathan Lyon as well. That set Australia just 170. That didn't look like anywhere near enough, and it certainly proved not to be enough, as they didn't lose a wicket. Warner and Cam Bancroft on debut with unbeaten 80 odds. As they eased to the victory to put themselves 1-0 up with four to play. I think I did a better job than Alexa there. Certainly went on even longer than she does.
It was comprehensive, as ever.
So, Tone, can you make some sense of this for me? We were very nervous, weren't we, on the eve of the game, both in our, you know, in our in-depth podcast previews and also in that Facebook Live that we did on the day itself, where we managed to talk ourselves into being much more nervous than we were coming into it. So we were nervous that England could be in for a very tough time. We thought, you know, they could be in for a walloping. In the end, it was a walloping, wasn't it? A 10-wicket defeat. But there were, as I say, there were various stages throughout the game where they were on top. You know, after 3 days, or at least after 2 3/4 days, it was still very much in the balance. So how should we feel about this then? Was it really a walloping? Or are there actually reasons to be positive about it? To put it another way, Joe Root has said it doesn't feel like a 10-wicket defeat. Would you agree with that? That's about 15 questions there.
Just pick and choose.
Just answer one of them.
Just choose two, worth 4 marks each. I would agree. Yeah, it doesn't feel like a 10-wicket defeat, although the fact that it is a 10-wicket defeat is a bit troubling because it doesn't get any more categoric than that. So for England to start a series, which they were already nervous about, with a 10-wicket defeat is unsettling.
Yeah, and also, you know, there's a sense that England actually played reasonably well. So if they're going to play reasonably well and lose by 10 wickets, that doesn't bode particularly positively either.
No. I mean, I agree with you. You know, the way the match developed, you know, you do wonder how England lost by 10 wickets. And you know, the answer is Steve Smith, really. You know, when he came in, Australia had 59 on the board in their first innings. And, you know, and wickets were being ripped out at the other end as well. And you know, he stuck it out. And, it was a fairly astonishing innings all round. He didn't really give anything away. There was that one pull shot which, looked very uncertain and dropped, you know, just kind of in between two England fielders, didn't it? And, you know, obviously it's all ifs and buts. If that drops into the hands of Stoneman out there, then possibly we're looking at a different match, but that's not obviously how life or cricket works. To get 141 on the board, it was strange because Australia only had such a slender first innings lead, but yet when England took the 10th wicket, it was just like, it just felt so flat. And then, with only a slender first innings lead, what was it, about 21 or something, for Australia, suddenly, out of nowhere, we're right on top of the match. And you just sort of kind of, how did that happen?
It was the momentum, wasn't it?
It was,
it's all about momentum. because it did just feel, you know, when Australia lost their seventh wicket and they were still, you know, the best part of 100 runs behind, at that stage it felt as though England were well on top in the game. And so for them to end up conceding a lead, it was just very deflating, I think. And then it was particularly the, as I mentioned in my lengthy roundup, it was the timing as well, the fact that they had that really awkward kind of 10, 15 overs to bat at the end of the day. It didn't instill much confidence because you really felt that there could only be wickets there. And there were only a couple, but even then it was like, well, you know, they started day four just, what, three or four runs ahead. And you thought, it's really only going one way from here.
If you transposed Smith's innings onto Joe Root in that first innings, then, you know, it's England are way ahead in this game. And, you know, that's obviously, again, not how life or cricket works, but...
You've learned some hard lessons this week.
Yeah, exactly. But then, you know, you've just got to hold your hands up and say, bloody hell, Steve, good innings, mate.
Was that your Australian accent?
No, it just came out a bit like that. I don't know where that came from.
I think it's disrespectful, Tone, to do an Australian accent on this show. It's disrespectful to our Australian listeners. I would never do that.
Yeah, because, you know...
Bloody hell.
You look around the rest of the Australian team in that first innings, and you know, apart from that nice little partnership between him and Marsh, when Marsh did look quite good at times, you know, there wasn't really much there. So Steve Smith basically dug them out and won them the game. Yeah, and obviously England will be very, very disappointed not to have set a bigger total, of course, and then not even to have got a couple of three wickets, you know, for Australia to have sort of romped along so comfortably will be a bit of a concern as well.
That's pretty deflating as well, isn't it? It's a bit of a lesson as well, you know, speaking of learning hard lessons, it's a bit of a lesson as well that increasingly I feel, and I'm as guilty of this as anyone, it's increasingly tempting to sort of make sweeping conclusions about things off the back of quite a short period of Test cricket. Like, ultimately, the end of the game is all that really matters. I mean, that's a simplification, you know, you can draw conclusions from different aspects of the game. But what I mean is, like, at lunch on day one, when England were 59 for one, Michael Vaughan was saying, well, England have destroyed the myth of Stark and Hazlewood. You know, it's like the commentators were getting so carried away with how England had made a brilliant start to the tour, how, you know, all predictions of 5-0 were looking really silly. And it's like, it's 59 for one. But as I say, I'm guilty of it too. And after day one, I was feeling really quite optimistic. And yeah, as I say, ultimately it is only the final result that matters. And you know, even now it's only the final result of the series that matters, I suppose. But, you know, Test cricket is a long game and you should only really draw conclusions after a long period of time. And not, it's kind of the Twitter thing, isn't it? I want to be able to tweet something every 2 minutes. So it's like...
Well, no, I think, you know, you're spot on there. It was weird. I mean, the day one, it was an odd experience watching it because obviously England limped along. It was very, very cagey, patient stuff. But actually, yeah, at the end of the first day, you'd say, you know, they're in a good situation. And particularly when Milan was going so well, got out, Ali got out. At that, you know, at that point, you thought, yeah, England are going to make, you know, England are going to at least make 400. Then they were both gone in the blink of an eye, and suddenly again it's a different game.
I've got a list of things to be worried about, Tone, and I've got a list of things to be positive about. Which would you like first?
Positive.
Okay, well, that's a shorter list. But let's
get out the way.
Exactly. So let's knock that out quickly. No, I mean there definitely are things to take out of the game, as you say, when Milan and Ali were going well after Stoneman and Vince had gone well. You did feel that, as Michael Vaughan did, you did feel that England had made a really good start to the tour and things were looking up. But I don't know whether to put that on the positive list or the worried list, because...
straddles both.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, because also in the Australian first innings, when, as we say, they were, what, 200 for seven, I don't know whether it's a... encouraging sign that England managed to get themselves into strong positions twice, or a worrying sign that they threw those strong positions away. But, you know, if we're going to be optimists about it, we can say that at least they've shown they can be competitive with Australia. They can get the better of Australia in passages of play. They just need to, you know, translate that into a full performance. One reason to be positive is that as we've seen this year and over the last few years, things do change very quickly in Test cricket. And so I don't want to be too dramatic about anything that we say today, really, because as I've just said, ultimately, it's only the result of the series that matters. And there's still four tests to play here. There's still a lot of cricket left to be played. And as we saw in the South Africa series in the summer, when England won, you know, thrashed South Africa 1 week, got absolutely battered the next week, and then won comfortably the week after that. As we saw in the previous Ashes series in England, which finished 3-2, with every single game being incredibly one-sided. For whatever reason, in recent years, momentum is changing incredibly quickly in Test cricket. So there's maybe reasons to think that the same sort of thing could happen here, at least. At least there's a possibility of it.
Yeah, and exactly. Yeah, you know, on the preview pod, you know, I think I said, and you know, we thought, you know, in a series like this where both batting lineups look a bit fragile, a bit uncertain, that, you know, anyone who makes runs is going to have to earn them, and they're going to be so important. It's only going to take one or two, you know, performances to win a match. You know, it's not going to be a landslide of runs. I don't know. Maybe later on in the series when things have settled in a little bit. But exactly, that's the thing. And that's what we saw. Steve Smith did the job. Now, the big worry for me is, you know, how are England going to get it? You know, how are England going to stop him doing that, you know, time in, time out? And it is a little bit on Joe Root. Can he match him?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you say, the difference between the sides was Steve Smith. Australia's other kind of gun batsman is David Warner, and England got Warner out in the first innings, but they didn't get him out in the second innings. So actually, for three innings, they only got Australia's two key players out once, and they scored, well over 200 runs between them for once out, whereas Cook and Root, you know, scored less than 100 runs between them for four times out. So yes, England's gun players need to stand up in the way that Australia's did in the first test. But actually, maybe that's another reason to be encouraged, because England did compete and they did better with the bat than we expected. And that was without major contributions from Cook or Root. Root did get a 50, didn't he, in the second innings. But in the first innings, England, you know, got over 300 without runs from either of their key players. England's problem batsmen, you know, the positions that we identified as being problems, the three Ashes debutants in Stoneman and Vince and Milan, you know, they were the standouts, weren't they, in the first innings? They all got 50s. Vince got 80. You backed Vince to come good. Were you impressed with him? And more to the point, were you impressed with yourself?
I saw a few people picking up on it. It's good to see it didn't go unnoticed.
It went viral, actually, I think. Yeah.
For me, the feeling reminded me of when I topped the table in fantasy cricket on day one. It was like, yes, I am good. I am right. Well done, me. But then the nagging sense that actually it's just going to fall away and I'm going to just sink like a, I don't know, something that doesn't sink rapidly, but very slowly, like a whale carcass. But I hope I'm wrong. I don't know. No,
sinking like a whale carcass would be a good strap line for the World Cricket Cup.
I'm still backing Vince. It was a great innings. And actually, you know, you talk about just, it is always fine margins, isn't it? And the run out for Vince is unlucky in a way, because it's such a good piece of fielding that you can't always legislate for that. And you've just got to say well done to Lyon. And, you know, at that point, Vince is going really well. And yeah, again, that's a potentially a small game-changing moment.
Mark Stoneman I was particularly impressed with. I thought he did play very well, didn't score as many as Vince in the first innings, but I thought he played the short ball really well. His technique looked really good against the short ball, and considering they're going to keep getting a barrage of short bowling, particularly if the pitches are a bit bouncier going forward, a bit quicker, you know, that's something to cling to, I suppose. Something else on my positive list, Joe Root, I thought, captained well. Again, not for the entire match. He lost the plot a little bit when Smith and Cummins were batting. But at least for the first half of the Australian innings, I thought he captained well. You know, inventive field placings, unpredictable bowling changes, that kind of proactive captaincy that we haven't really seen from an England captain since Michael Vaughan, really, which is getting on for a decade now. I thought Anderson and Broad bowled decently, again, mainly in the first innings, not so much in the second innings when England failed to take a wicket, but they bowled pretty well first time round. But again, this is sort of half good, half bad, because they bowled well, but they're going to have to do an awful lot of bowling in this series. So You know, it's a little bit worrying to think how many overs they're going to have to get through. I've run out now of positives. Shall I move on to the worried list?
Yeah, hit me.
My list of worries. Have you got
an hour? You look pained.
Have you got an hour and a half or so? How much battery's in the recorder? Number one, the tail. As we talked about on the preview, the tail, the lower order, was so crucial 4 years ago. It was, you know, a slightly underreported thing, but it was actually one of the major differences between the sides in that 5-0 whitewash was the strength of the lower order. England kept getting themselves into half decent positions and then getting absolutely obliterated and, you know, losing their last five wickets for six runs. Whereas Australia kept getting into similar sorts of positions as England, five down, but adding another 200, 250 runs. As I say, I don't want to draw too many sweeping conclusions, but it looks as though something similar could happen again. In this test, in the first innings, England's last five wickets scored 56 runs. And in the second innings, their last five wickets scored 82 runs. In the second innings, their last three wickets could only manage 10 runs. Whereas Australia, in their first innings, their last three wickets scored 119 runs. So just that lower order for Australia of Stark, Cummins, there's strength there.
And then, yeah, they've always got Smith at the other end.
Exactly, yeah. So that is quite a strong lower order. Whereas England, I mean, Wokes should be in that kind of company, although he didn't really look like it in this game. But certainly, you know, Broad, Ball and Anderson is, you know, all three of them, you'd say, at the moment at least, look like number 11. So that's got to be a concern, hasn't it? Particularly if the Australian fast bowlers are delivering this kind of onslaught of short pitch bowling. England's tail looks weaker than Australia's, and also England's tail is having to face, you know, much more difficult bowling for tailenders to face than Australia's are, just because there's so much more pace in the Australian attack. I mean, there's not necessarily much you can do about that. You can't sort of, you can't teach Jake Ball how to bat. You can't teach them how to stand up against fast, short pitch bowling in a few days. Although it was slightly surprising, slightly galling to see Trevor Bayliss, the coach. He was asked about it. He said, well, you know, at least we know what to expect now. You think, well, possibly we could have predicted that.
Yeah.
Another worry, Nathan Lyon bowling to left-handers. This was something that really stuck out during the game, wasn't it? England have got a lot of left-handers, and Lyon looks like he's going to take a wicket more or less every ball that he bowls to left-handers. Reminded me a little bit of Graham Swann in his heyday.
He bowled very, very well, didn't he? And I don't think he took a wicket on day one, did he? But he certainly, maybe not quite changed the game on day one, but he certainly brought a whole lot to Australia's attack on day one, and you know, his overall performance in the match, the sort of crucial wickets on the second day to turn the match back in, or certainly to at least rein England back in. Yeah, he was very impressive. That's not what we want to see off the back of all the chat ahead of the ahead of the series. As you say, yeah, the left-hand thing, that is going to be, you know, figuring perhaps Bairstow bat, you know, should bat one higher, just to sort of mix it up a little bit.
Break up
that left-handers. That lower middle order.
Mm. So yeah, there's what, four left-handers in the top six? So yeah, if Bairstow swapped with Moeen, maybe that might break things up a bit. But then having said that, Moeen was probably the most comfortable. He was certainly the most comfortable of the left-handers against Nathan Lyon. In some ways, he looked like England's best batsman in this game, although he didn't go on and get a score. There has been a lot of talk, like certainly, I think it was Gilchrist, maybe Ponting, one of the Aussies, was saying, you know, well, Moeen batted really well against Lyon, and the reason he looked so much better was because he actually tried to be positive. He tried to take him on, played a few shots, and maybe some of the other England batsmen should try and do that. Milan and Stoneman just seemed to be content to try and sit in against Lyon, and he was bowling so well and turning it so much that you felt at some point he's going to take the outside edge and he's just going to bowl a ball that's too good. So maybe you should take the Moeen approach of trying to play a few shots, put the pressure back on him, get him to try and change his length, that kind of thing. And that makes sense to me. But if you're going to argue that they should do that, I think the commentators then need to be prepared to be forgiving of batsmen if they then pick out long off.
This is your pet hate.
It is my pet hate, yeah.
Definitely.
Oh, it's one of many. But yes, well, but you know that will happen, won't it? David Milan will skip down the wicket, hole out to long on, and Boycott and Vaughan will be writing articles about, you know, they'll just be incensed at what a stupid shot that was to play.
Speaking of Boycott, it's interesting hearing him do tele commentary again. I don't know whether he's trying to be, he's trying to do something different to what he has done on TMS, but it's certainly, I don't, you know, stuff would happen, wickets would fall, and he'd be going, you know, Broad took a wicket thing, and he was just like, that's why he's the best.
He did that. Yeah.
I think he did it about four or five times.
We may be thinking of the same moment, but yeah, when Broad took a wicket and Boycott was going, Broad and Anderson, I told you, Broad and Anderson, they're brilliant bowlers. It's like, thanks, Jeffrey. So yeah, Lyon against left-handers is definitely a concern. Speaking of left-handers, Alistair Cook had quite a poor test, two failures. And actually, he's now gone, Tone, believe this, if you will, he's now gone 16 Ashes tests without a century. Should we be worried about Cook? Are you worried about Cook?
Yes, slightly.
Yes!
Slightly. He just didn't look good, did he? I mean, he didn't have a lot of time to look good because he was gone fairly swiftly. There was a lot of
time to look good because he was out.
Yeah, there was a lot of here we go comments on the first night for us.
Would that be on Twitter?
Some of them I saw on Twitter. Some on Facebook. Some out of my own mouth.
Some from the @cricketshow account on Twitter. You're talking about that first wicket of the test when Stark got Cook to nick off, and what was it? Was it about 5 for 1 at that stage?
Exactly. I mean, that was worrying. But then Vince and Stoneman went on and put on 120 odd, and at that point it was like, wow, this is going to be different.
Yeah.
Then it wasn't.
So, and then I was tweeting, the myth of Stark and Hazelwood has been absolutely destroyed.
But Cook, it does look a bit of a concern. I mean, it wasn't a great shot
in the second innings,
exactly. That the hook. You know, you said before about players, you're playing shots, but Cook should know better than to play that then.
Yeah, no.
Just I didn't need to do it.
I do agree with that. Like, so, you know, for new listeners, my pet hate is that people, you know, commentators are so quick to call, you know, to criticise players when they get caught on the boundary or they top edge a hook, or, you know, this idea that it's such a stupid shot when actually if they connected with it and it went for six, they'd be like, wow, so brave, look at that, not afraid to take on the short ball. And it's ultimately, that is the game, isn't it? That the game is calculating risks. And so I'm loath to criticize players for the shot selection. You can criticize it for the execution. However, there are, you know, there's circumstances make a difference, match situation. And as I've said, that situation in the match when, you know, towards the end of day three, England just had 10, 15 overs to bat. They just needed to try and get through to the close. Alistair Cook doesn't really need to be playing a pull shot in that situation. Again, if he had hit it for four, everyone would be saying, oh, brilliant, what a good shot. No one would be saying, if it went for four, no one would be saying, well, that was a bit risky. But he did get it wrong, and he didn't need to take the risk in that. He shouldn't have taken the risk in that situation.
Yeah, but it just struck me as a little bit sloppy. And you
particularly
know,
when the trap was set for that. As
yeah.
Well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Alistair Cook's an England legend and an Ashes legend, even if he's not put his hand up in the last 16 tests.
Well, a lot of players don't play as many as 16 Ashes tests. A lot of players who have long careers don't play that many tests, and that's how many Cook has gone without scoring a century.
He is and has shown himself to be, you know, a fantastic disciplinarian out there in the middle, hasn't he? But that is a slight concern that he fell to that.
Listen, I'm not trying to panic anybody about Cook, but there is, you know, there is a little bit of a broader pattern that has gone slightly under the radar in that, I mean, this might be overstating it slightly, but you could argue that he's in a bit of a slow decline in that, yeah, he scored one century in the last 12 months, which is 12 tests now. And over the last few years, he scored six centuries in his last 47 tests, when he'd scored 10 in the 37 before that and 8 in the 28 before that. So if I were to draw a line graph, Tone, if you asked me to draw a line graph, the line would be going downwards, wouldn't it? And, you know, it's not disastrous, 600s in 47 tests, but that's more tests than it's taken Ben Stokes, for example, to score six test hundreds, and Ben Stokes isn't batting at the top of the order.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's too much to expect Cook to produce and reproduce what he did in 2010. You know, that was a special performance. It anchored that whole series for England. But you just hope he can get a few 50s and just kind of help England on their way. And he's not doing that enough at the moment.
No, I mean, there's still no reason to think that he can't do that. He's still obviously a quality player, and there's no one else that you'd have instead of him. But just for England's sake, you hope, as we say, they really need both Cook and Root to stand up in the remainder of the series. If Cook and Root have poor series, there's absolutely no way that England are winning this, particularly if Warner and Smith... sorry, I'm getting a bit choked up here. Just thinking about... God, it's a long way to go, isn't there? A lot of watching Steve Smith bat to do. Not a great game for England's bowlers either, you'd have to say. Obviously ended in pretty dismal fashion, failing to take a wicket in defending that target. Anderson and Broad were good, as I say, but they weren't outstanding. They didn't have their best game in England shirt, but they bowled reasonably well. But the support wasn't quite there from the other two seamers, was it? Here's a question, Tone. Jake Ball, what's the point?
Harsh. Ball point, is that the joke?
I mean, that is a very good joke.
That's not very good.
But that's not where I was going with it.
I think we said before the series, you know, it doesn't necessarily... He's not a player at the moment that excites us. And I don't think we saw a huge amount to suggest that's going to change overnight. Yeah, that it's a bit of a concern for sure. But where do England go?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm being deliberately provocative there, Tony. And so, you know, it is too harsh to say what's the point, but I've yet to see anything from Jake Ball in any of his appearances in an England shirt in any format to say that, you know, he's one of the best bowlers in one of the three or four best seam bowlers in the country. I feel a bit sorry for him in a sense, because it seemed like they asked him, certainly leading into the game, they were like, well, you know, yeah, Jake Ball's going to come and bounce them out. And that's not his strong suit, is it? And he's not quick enough to do that either. And that's the thing. With this whole England attack, they were all bowling sort of mid-80s tops, whereas Australia's attack are getting up into the 90s, and they just looked a lot slower, didn't they? And it looked, particularly on this pitch, I think, it was coming off, it was like that kind of tennis ball bounce when England's bowlers were bowling, whereas Australia were getting it to come through. And, you know, when it went from, on the third day when Australia finished their innings, when England came out to bat, the commentators were saying, oh, suddenly it looks like the pitch is quickening up. And it's like, well, it's just because it's Stark and Cummins rather than Ball and Wokes and Broad. But as you say, I mean, where do England go? This is true with the spinner as well, because Moeen struggled. It certainly was nowhere near as dangerous or effective as Nathan Lyon. And in fact, in that second innings, Joe Root ended up doing quite a big share of the bowling. I mean, Moeen said Moeen's got this cut on his finger, so that could be the problem. It could also be that Lyon is just a better bowler than Moeen, and that's not necessarily a criticism of Moeen, because I do think Lyon is a fantastic bowler. But as you say, where do England go? The difficulty is, we keep coming back to this thing that they've picked the wrong squad, or they've picked a bad squad. If Moeen is struggling, it might make sense to bring in another spinner, bring in a frontline spinner, leave out Jake Ball, play Moeen as a sort of second spinner, second spinning all-rounder. But who would that be? Mason Crane is the only other bowler in the squad. I don't know whether you'd have much confidence in him sort of leading the way in his debut test against Australia. I mean,
it's huge pressure, isn't it? Yeah. And already, you know, if he was to come in Adelaide, you know, England are already 1-0 down. So they're up against it. The pressure's on. You know, you don't want to say whitewash, but there we go. that's got to be, it's got to be a real possibility.
It's out there.
It is out there. It's like the John Lewis Christmas ad, isn't it? You know, you know it's coming out, but you just didn't know quite when. And then suddenly it arrives, and that's all anyone's talking about. Yeah, that's huge pressure. Now, of course, putting him in the squad and not picking him for the first, you know, they must have, you know, the selectors or, you know, would have known probably what their squad was going to be, or their team rather, was going to be for the first test. More or less, you'd hope they would have done. And the fact that Crane wasn't there, they must know that, they must have expected, take him along, that he's going to be coming in a situation later on in the series. So, you know, hopefully he's up to it.
Well, maybe, but you almost feel like they've picked him like to give him some experience, which they've done with some players in the past, and I've never really understood. I don't know. Or maybe they were, you know, if Moeen was bowling grenades, you know, if Moeen was at his best, then maybe they were thinking, let's play Mason Crane as a second spinner in Sydney. But if Moeen is struggling with injury or whatever else, and they think we need to pick someone to be the spinner, I don't know that Mason Crane is the right guy. I mean, again, who it would be, Adil Rashid has obviously got, you know, is obviously not a perfect solution either, and anyone else would be making their debut as well, whether it was Jack Leach or somebody else. So there's not, yeah, there's no perfect solution, but Mason Crane, you'd just fear for him a bit against David Warner, particularly. You would think it could be sort of career ending Simon Kerrigan territory if he was chucked into the fray and asked to lead the line. And it's the same with the fast bowlers as well. If they're going to leave out Jake Ball, there's no obvious candidate to replace him in the squad. As I say, England were lacking for pace. Probably the two fastest bowlers in England, or at least the two fastest sort of options for England, would be Mark Wood and Liam Plunkett, and neither of them are in the squad. I mean, there is this thing that both have gotten much better because they didn't play, which is the thing that always happens.
Yeah.
And Mark Wood played against South Africa and was anonymous, you know, didn't do anything. So it's not as if Mark Wood would be the answer to all of England's prayers, but you do just think that, you know, they need an injection of pace, and I'm not sure that either Craig Overton or Tom Curran can provide that. So yeah, it's not a great squad really that they've picked.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, they have been unfortunate.
They've
not
created a problem for themselves.
Yeah, I agree. Although they have been slightly unfortunate, there's not a bottomless pit of lightning quick world class bowlers. You know, there never will be, and they have suffered. Obviously, Finn got injured. You know, Roland Jones did look bloody good in the summer. Obviously, got injured. So yeah, it's hard, isn't it? It's tough. We haven't mentioned his name yet, but I'm sure you might mention it in a minute.
Mark Ramprakash.
Yeah, exactly. He is got to be out there. Get him on the plane. No, I mean, Ben Stokes, you know, obviously would, again, you know, that the bowling attack just looks better with him in it, and he's not there. So it's another slightly unfortunate, if self-inflicted incident, self-inflicted issue.
Or is he, Tone? Is he there?
Well, you were caught out by the fake news the other day. Although he is definitely in New Zealand now, we know that. He's landed.
It was all over Twitter, pictures of Stokes at Heathrow. But it turns out he's actually going to New Zealand rather than Australia.
I mean, it's close enough in my head. It's like the difference between Guernsey and Jersey.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like you're in the area.
It's like the difference between St. Peterport and St. Martin's, isn't it? I mean, to be fair, that probably is part of his thinking, though.
It's got to be, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's got to be.
He's gone out, apparently, to spend some time with his family, and he'll be practicing out there and possibly
Apparently he's going to play in a 50-over game on Sunday, isn't he? I mean, he's obviously not going to play the second test.
No.
But I would be very surprised if he doesn't play some part in the series now.
Well, it depends, though, doesn't it? Because I would be surprised if they drop the investigation, then he will play. But if they say, no, we're going to press charges, then he won't play.
True. But you'd think they're going to drop the investigation. Well, based on, I know there's been, look, everyone's a police expert on Twitter now and you know, procedural kind of guru. But I don't know. Surely, if you're going to press charges, you wouldn't let him fly to New Zealand.
Well, maybe, maybe not. Maybe he's taken it, you know, taken it upon himself, and they've said, well, we're not going to stop you. But yeah, it may have been that he's had, you know, a wink and a nod from someone, and they've said, yeah, you know, give it a week and then you'll be able to go. And he's thought, well, I'll go to New Zealand now, and then he can acclimatise to the time difference and that kind of stuff, and be closer. But he might not know anything, and he might be thinking, well, I'll do this in case the investigation is dropped. I mean, I genuinely don't know.
I know, no one knows.
Exactly.
I mean,
I don't want to be taken in by fake news again, is what I'm trying to say to him. I've had my fingers burnt.
I don't know. You know, and in a way, actually, whilst it obviously has been hugely detrimental to England's chances in the series, it was a huge distraction. Ahead of the series, him going to New Zealand now is a good distraction, I think, for England, because yeah, obviously that's all anyone's talking about. He's taken the heat off the actual result somewhat. Obviously, the reason why everyone's talking about him is because they're worried England are going to get hammered again. And yeah, obviously they want to see him there, but yeah, at least it gives the England players a bit of time out of the limelight for the next day, I suppose, or a couple of days.
They've had a few distractions, haven't they? Because there's been all this Johnny Bairstow stuff as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was nonsense.
Reports that he headbutted Cameron Bancroft in a bar in Perth about a month ago. And this came out, it was picked up on the stump microphone, wasn't it? That the Australian players were, you know, were giving Bairstow some banter, I think is the word, Tane, about this. And this was picked up and asked about, and they discovered that this had happened. It was very weird, though, wasn't it? Yeah, there's a Cameron Bancroft gave what was quite a funny press conference where he, you know, explained what happened as he saw it, and he said, you know, I just thought it was a bit weird because it wasn't like a he said it wasn't like a violent headbutt. It was just instead of a handshake, he headbutted him.
Yeah, I mean, you know. I mean, it's hard to disagree that that is weird.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, what was the context? They're all out in a bar. I don't know. The whole thing was blown so far out of proportion. You know, and as soon as you start calling it a headbutt, and that press conference was stupid. Mm. You know, bloody people asking, like, oh, you know, just very specifics of just get on with it. I mean, it was utter nonsense as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, I saw some people saying, oh, you know, that's... You know, that's going to be, it's like an iconic moment, you know, it's going to haunt England forever, the, you know, the giggling at the press conference.
Mm.
And, you know, that will pick for sure. But I mean, I don't think it's any more haunting than, you know, Stuart Broad's face after his eighth at Trent Bridge.
No, true.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's all in good Australia and the Australian players having a laugh about it, because it is, yeah, it is quite amusing, and certainly Bancroft played it up in that instance. But I don't know, the way it was being framed to me from some quarters are this, you know, it's as if Australia have got this power over England, that they're now in hysterics about, you know, Australia haven't won an Ashes series in England for ages. The pressure is on, I think, you know, the pressure is on Australia more so.
Yeah. Well,
whatever happens, yeah, if Australia do win the series, and, you know, obviously they've put themselves in a good position, they've still not, you still wouldn't say, well, this Australian side has been, it hasn't even had the lion's share of Ashes series in the last 10 years.
This is your Kevin Keegan moment.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I would love it.
They've still got to go to Middlesbrough and get something.
So, I don't know. I thought people were sort of jumping the gun slightly on that.
No, I agree. And again, it kind of, whether or not that haunts England does depend on what happens.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
If it turns into 5-0 whitewash, then maybe. If not, you know, then everyone will forget about it. But I agree. I just thought it was a bit nonsense, really. It just doesn't matter. I mean, it's very weird. Very weird thing to have happened. But not something to really dwell on, I don't think.
No, exactly. You know, it's the classic thing, though. The word headbutt, obviously, is that's got a strong connotation. And, you know, as soon as, like, oh, you know, Johnny Bairstow headbutted Cameron Bancroft, and that's all over the newspaper. You know, obviously people are going to be like, I don't know, it's sort of slightly... But it's fake news, isn't it?
You keep saying that. It's the 15th time you said that today.
It's a bit worrying, actually. Oh no, I shouldn't say it. No, it's misleading. It's tabloid.
Right. Okay.
That's a better word for it. Can you bleep all my uses of fake news?
Ever since you started working at ITV, you keep calling the BBC fake news.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Should we talk about Australia?
Yeah.
They are the other team taking part in the Ashes this year. We talked about this on our Facebook Live today, and there was quite a bit of controversy, wasn't there, when the Australia squad was announced. Or maybe controversy is the wrong word, but there was quite a bit of discussion about that Australia squad announcement, because there were some unexpected names in there, some unexpected inclusions in, well, Cameron Bancroft and Sean Marsh and Tim Payne particularly. But I posited on our Facebook Live...
Good word.
I think it was me that was making the great point, saying that I wondered if the headline surprises of that squad might have made us lose sight of the fact that they still had more than enough about them to be favourites against England. So, like, because of that squad announcement, people were saying, including both of us, well, actually, maybe this has opened the door for England a little bit, that... You know, that Australia have created a problem for themselves, that suddenly we were feeling a little bit more confident. A lot of people were feeling much more confident. But did that squad announcement actually just distract us from the fact that, you know, Australia still have Steve Smith, Dave Warner, a strong bowling attack? You know, they still had the stronger team.
Yeah, slightly. And I think we said that at the time, didn't, as you just said.
I think I said that. Yeah.
No, I think I think I said that as well.
Well,
I definitely said that. I think that's pretty accurate, isn't it? We talked ourselves out of the optimism that the squad announcement brought. Yeah, I mean, again, it just comes back to what we said at the start. Like, Steve Smith, he's just too good at the moment. Yeah, I don't know. What's the latest stat from you on since he became good?
My previous since he became good stat was that he's averaging 70 in Test cricket since he became good. But that must have gone up now to probably 72 or 73 after that innings, because his overall Test average is above 60 again. There's another stat here. I mean, because, you know, people before the series were talking up the battle between him and Root, which is obviously, you know, that it's understandable why people would be talking that up, because they're similar age, they're one and two in the world, they're both captains. People talk a lot about Smith and Root, along with Williamson and Kohli, as, you know, the four standout players of this generation. But actually, there's no real comparison. I mean, but in terms of average, hundreds, I mean,
yeah, he's leaving them all behind. I mean, I suppose the only comparison is it's the role that he plays in the team as captain and headline batsman. But as you say, yeah, he's taken off.
The vitalness to the team, I suppose, but just a direct comparison player for player. I mean, the hundreds thing is pretty telling. I mean, that was Smith's 21st Test 100. Root has 13 from a couple more matches. Root's conversion rate actually is becoming more and more of a problem, or more and more obviously a problem. His conversion rate from 50 to 100 is 28%. So less than a third of the time that he gets to 50, he goes on and makes 100. Smith's conversion rate is over 50%. Yeah, as I say, there's not really a comparison between them. I mean, it's not always pretty, you know, it's not always great to watch. He's not Brian Lara on the eye, you know, with that kind of crab-like shuffle around. He hasn't got every shot in the book necessarily, or at least, you know, he might have the shots, but he doesn't always play them or play them that attractively. But there's no arguing with the statistics. The numbers are extraordinary, and he is, you know, he's pulled further ahead in the ICC rankings, or the ICC player ratings. His rating has gone up again. He's now joint fifth on the all-time list. So only four other players have ever had a higher rating than him on the ICC system, which I think is Bradman, Hutton, Hobbs and Ponting. And he's level with Peter May. So, I mean,
decent company.
Not bad company to be in. How can England get him out, Tone? Can they get him out?
I don't know. I mean, they did perhaps, you know, they let him settle a bit too much. They gave him long periods. I don't know. You know, you've just got to take your chances. I suppose there was that one wobble, but there wasn't much. He looked pretty imperious.
He didn't really offer chances. No. You say there was one miscontrolled pull shot, but it wasn't really a chance, was it?
Particularly for that innings, and, you know, I guess in recent history, an uncharacteristically sloppy shot, but yeah, it didn't yield a direct chance.
And he didn't even really play a miss. So maybe it's a case of just getting everyone else out quicker so that he can't score as many while he's in. We talked up the Australian bowling attack quite a lot on our preview show, Tone. I mean, with the exception of Nathan Lyon, who we talked about, they were possibly a little bit underwhelming, particularly Mitchell Stark, who we were really talking up. I mean, he was definitely not at his best, I think it's fair to say. But in some ways, is it actually quite alarming for England that they've been beaten so comprehensively and the Australian bowlers haven't even bowled very well?
Somewhat.
Where's the optimism?
Exactly, I'm looking for it.
Are there some places to be optimistic in this Australian team? Maybe there is still that weakness in the batting.
Yeah, it's a 10-wicket defeat at the end of the day. It doesn't get any more one-sided than that. But yeah, the frustrating thing is England, for a significant proportion of the match, were, you know, competing, even out-competing Australia. But it was just that Smith sticking point. I think we'll know a bit more after Adelaide.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose England couldn't ask for a better opportunity, could they, to get themselves back into the series. A day-night test in Adelaide. Pink ball should move around a little bit. You know, that does present them with something, doesn't it?
It's an enticing prospect. Yeah, you know, straight into it, it's different. There's a wild card element. I think if England get walloped in this, then, you start to worry heavily.
Mm, yeah, no, they have to win really here, yeah. Don't they? Because this is probably their best chance of winning a test in the series. If they don't win here, you know, it's hard to see where they do win. But also, yeah, if they lose and lose heavily, I think it will be 5-0. So, again, a lot riding on this test, a lot riding on this first day, on this first session, a crucial first session in Adelaide.
I mean, if just to use your word, if I posit this for you, is that the right use of it?
Ooh,
I'm not going to make a deposit.
Sounding very sophisticated, yeah. All of a sudden thing.
But if Australia do win 5-0 in this series, it, you know, the next tour, yeah, it's just 3 5-0s in a row would be, you know, I don't know. What does that do to the brain of a young English cricketer?
It wouldn't be 3 in a row. It would be 3 out of 4.
Oh, sorry, 3 out of 4. Sorry, yeah. But, I mean, yeah, that's
you've lost worrying. I've lost all that credibility that built up by using the word posit.
You can cut that, actually, now. I'll say it again.
I probably won't cut it.
You have to cut it.
Go on, say it again.
If Australia were to win 5-0, yeah, 3 out of 4 series, whitewashes, it's pretty troubling. Obviously, there was a superhuman performance from Cook in 2010. But what does that say to the next England touring party? It's that you need a superhuman performance from someone, and that's tough to find.
Mm.
It's troubling.
Particularly because it's getting to the point in our lives now as well where we're quite a bit older than most of the England players. And so another 4 years down the road, there could be players in that team who barely remember that 2010 victory. They barely remember anything other than a 5-0 whitewash. Although, to be fair, we can barely remember anything other than I can remember 5-0 white, apart from the 2010 victory, I can remember 5-0 whitewashes and a 4-1 defeat yeah. in 2002. So maybe that's why I never made it as a cricketer. But I was just thinking, you know, for someone like Jake Ball, who said that his idol growing up was Steve Harmison, and Harmison I think of as a recent player, not someone that was a sort of boyhood idol. Do you know what I mean? Like, if it's going to get to the point soon where there's players who can't remember anything other than a 5-0 whitewash, potentially.
Yeah.
If this turns out to be a 5-0 whitewash.
We're getting very negative. I mean, I got a couple of messages on the other day, just people saying I've put money on a 5-0 whitewash.
Really?
Money is going down on it. It's worrying.
But England have made a habit of getting hammered and then bouncing back really well the following week. And it happened in the Ashes series in England. They won the first test really well, but then got hammered in the second test. And everyone said, well, this is going to be 4-1 now. And actually, England came back and won the next two games and won the series. So it's not impossible, but I'm not putting a lot of money on it. This is the most important question I'll ask you tonight, Tone. What did you make of the BT coverage?
That was interesting. It was interesting. I mean, there's lots of threads we could pick up on here. I mean, I felt slightly seasick by about half an hour in. The camera work is a little bit strange. I mean, I assume that's not BT cameras.
I don't think that's BT's fault.
But you
sent me that message saying what's going on with the camera work, and I hadn't like consciously articulated that thought. But then I was like, oh yeah, the camera work.
Then
is.
You tweeted it.
And then I immediately tweeted it and didn't credit you.
That's all right. I don't think it's that original thought. But yeah, the camera work's just a little bit jumpy for me.
Mm. I think it settled down as the test went on, but on that first day, yeah, they kind of missed. They weren't really getting that first wicket when Cook got out. There was no real replay of Hanscom taking the catch because the camera just wasn't following it properly. And we're just so used to world-class camera work, aren't we? In tests in England, that it was a bit disorienting.
Yeah, that's the word, disorienting. Well done.
Oh, thanks very much.
I mean, I thought it was interesting. Actually, I don't mind the commentators. I've not had any issues with that yet. It did make me laugh at the start on day one. Matt Smith hosting, anchoring the whole thing, and then he was in the commentary box. Yeah. It sort of cut to the commentary box early on, and he was sat there, and then we didn't hear from him at all. But yeah, he was still sat there about an hour and a half later, just listening in.
Yeah, cut back to the commentators just in the middle of a conversation, and Matt Smith was just sat in the background nodding.
He was in the sort of what to use Sky parlance, the sort of third man slot, but he didn't chip in at all.
It was weird. It looked as though they weren't letting him leave. He just had to sit there and look like he was entertained.
I'm also slightly disappointed that we didn't get the call up to work for BT, because certainly in the build up to the first session, I didn't really quite get the point of the second presentation position on the pitch with Alison Mitchell and Swan and Fleming.
Yeah, they had two tables, two desks to stand around.
It was just the sort of the same thing, but different.
Let's just go to the other side of the ground to talk some more about cricket.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a rocky start, I thought, on the first day. The camera work, which obviously was not their fault, but also you mentioned earlier, Boycott is used to commentating on the radio. A few of them have really, most of the commentary they've done before is on the radio, and they were very, very talky, like talking a lot, which is partly excitement, I imagine, as well. And it was, BT coverage is new, and they were probably like pretty hyped up, I would imagine. But there was a lot of shouting and talking over the coverage. Or it is that thing where, I'm sort of there going, God, just let the pictures speak for themselves. So I was furiously writing on Twitter. It's like, I don't need anything other than the cricket to entertain me. I typed on Twitter.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
That opening VT as well. Do you remember that?
I don't know if I saw that. I might have just missed that.
You might
what happened in that?
Nodded off. It was there, like, introducing the Ashes VT. There was just lots of dramatic music and clips of old series interspersed with close-up shots of the commentators just saying one word. It was going like, history, bouncer, pride, enthralling. And Vaughan afterwards was like, God, that gets me going every time. Does it, Michael? Does it?
No, I missed that. I was actually went and watched the first day with a couple of friends.
A couple of your mates.
I did miss the very, very start. Got there just before the toss, so I saw most of that. Then went at lunch to keep us awake. We went on a beach walk in the driving wind and rain with two St. Bernard dogs.
Right.
Which is interesting. It's good. But then got back and it was raining, so that was really annoying. Yeah. Rain at the start of the second session should not be allowed.
I know.
In an Australian Ashes series.
I had to go to bed.
Because that's just the worst. I mean, it was annoying that there was sort of drizzle around anyway. But yeah, that's the worst possible time for it to come.
And it was raining in real life as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. I mean, obviously lots has been chatted over the years about the impact of cricket being on, pay TV. I think it's heightened by it being on BT. Obviously the Ashes gets a lot of coverage on the BBC Sport website, which for many people in the UK is the sort of the homepage of sport. But it is a shame.
Yeah, you mean it's heightened by BT because
it's almost another level of obstruction for people to go and see it.
Yeah, because a minority of people pay for Sky, have pay TV, but even fewer people have BT, I guess, or would pay for BT. And if you've already got Sky, and particularly if you're a cricket fan and you've decided, I am going to pay, I like cricket enough that I'm going to pay to have Sky to watch it. If there's then one series that you've got to pay for on top of that, it's that thing. I mean, people talk about it with the football as well, but it's like competition should be good for the consumer, but actually in this case, it's very bad for the consumer. And speaking of Sky, I mean, it does, as I say, I think it was a pretty rocky start for BT, although I think they did settle down and the commentary team I can pick faults with for sure. And, I certainly think someone needs to have a word with Swan. I think Boycott has definitely had his days, had his chips with me, Boycott, as far as I'm concerned. But I think there are some great commentators in there. I think Alison Mitchell's great. And I think the Aussie guys were all excellent as well, especially Ricky Ponting. I think he's one of the best commentators in the world. So I thought it settled down. I thought, broadly speaking, their coverage was okay, their coverage was decent. But it does go to illustrate, I think, what an amazing job Sky do. And whatever you think about the free-to-air, pay-TV debate, and I do think that the current setup is bad for the game. I think there does need to be some cricket on free-to-air, at the very least, some cricket on free-to-air. Whatever you think about that, and whatever you think about Rupert Murdoch, and I understand why some people don't want to pay Sky because they don't want to give their money to the Murdoch Empire. That's fair enough as well. But whatever you think about those things, there's no denying that the job Sky do of covering cricket is exceptionally good. I think it must be just about the best coverage of any sport in the world, or certainly that I've seen. I've sort of started to take that for granted. And when you see what BT were doing, which was fine, it's just not the same, is it? It's not Athers, it's not Hussein, and it's not the, you know, the really in-depth, like, Hawkeye and other kinds of analysis that they do. You know, there's no Ian Ward with his little TV that he carts around, that he drives around. I don't know, it's just, it really made me go, oh yeah, actually, Sky do an amazing job.
Yeah, agreed.
Much like the announcement of Prince Harry's engagement, this episode of The World Cricket Show has been a life-changing and extremely unexpected event that has received an appropriate level of news coverage all around the world. We've all had a jolly good time, but it's definitely time now to bring it to an end. You must have enjoyed that royal wedding announcement the other day, Tane.
Yeah, good news. Good news.
We'd better get a bank holiday. That's all I'll say about it.
But we're not.
Well, they've said we're not. But if we kick up enough of a stink, Tane, do you think we can get Theresa to change her mind?
I mean, it's a tough one. I don't want to talk about it anymore. No one cares.
What's going on this week, Tane? Did you have a good birthday the other day?
It was nice.
You're very keen for us all to know that it was your birthday coming up. Did you have a good one?
Yeah, very good. It began with me waking up on my friend's sofa and getting a taxi home at 6:45 in the morning.
That wasn't my sofa, was it? I know you threatened to come round to use my BT subscription. Once I'd gone to bed, I did think maybe I should leave a light on in case Tony pops around.
I managed to get a nap in on my birthday afternoon, so that was good. So yeah, it was all good.
Perfect day, really. Perfect birthday. A nap.
Exactly. And hey, we do it all, not my birthday, but we do it all again this weekend, don't we?
It's not your special day anymore, Tane. I'm sorry.
It's my birthday week.
Christmas is coming up though, so you'll get more presents, don't worry.
What did you get me?
The gift of laughter.
Yeah, that's good. That's priceless.
The gift that keeps on giving, isn't it?
So yeah, I'll see you on Saturday morning.
Yeah, you've offered to have us round.
Open the doors. Getting in the festive spirit.
Actually, aren't we coming round to yours on Saturday night as well?
You could just stay throughout.
I might as well, yeah. You're having Christmas drinks, aren't you?
Yeah.
In the evening. So yeah, maybe I should just stay for the day. Get a bit of a nap, have a bit of a kip in here, maybe. All right, well, we'll be back after the Adelaide Test to do more talking. But before that, if you like the World Cricket Show, there's various things you can do on the internet to get more involved. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/cricketshow. We're on Twitter at Cricket Show. I'm tweeting throughout the Ashes Tests when I'm watching them. If I'm not tweeting, it means I'm asleep. We're on Instagram as well, at World Cricket Show. Send us an email, worldcricketshow@gmail.com. And if you'd like to support the show, there's a few different ways you can do that. Write a review for us on iTunes or whichever podcast platform you use. Big thank you to everybody who has done that, because that does help to bring new listeners to the show. And if you want to support us financially, there's a couple of ways to do that. You can make a regular donation at patreon.com/cricketshow. And we'd like to thank all of our Patreon supporters who have helped to fund this new equipment, this new recording equipment that we're using that makes us sound so, so sexy. And the other way that you can support us financially is when you're doing your Amazon shopping. Christmas is coming up. I don't know if you've noticed. You may have seen the John Lewis advert. Christmas is coming. So if you're doing your shopping on Amazon this year, why not go first of all to our website, cricketshow.net. Click the link there. And then anything you buy doesn't cost you anything extra whatsoever. But we just get a little bit of a kickback. But yeah, that is it, I think, Tane.
Yeah, on to Adelaide.
On to Adelaide. Adelaide. It's a tough one to say, that, Tane.
Yeah.
Stay in school, guys, and we'll see you all next time. Bye bye for now.
Cheery. Thank you.
I've made the mistake of starting this podcast with my hoodie on, with my sweatshirt on. It's way too hot in here for that, so I'm just going to take it off. Hold on. Let's take off my
headphones. Try and commentate on this. Ugh.
Oh, God.
Oh, it's all happening.
Oh.
Wow.
That's more revealing than I intended.
Yeah, can you put that back on, please?
It's one for the outtakes, isn't it?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.